Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Susan Wilk, and I represent the appellant in this matter, DeMarco Mobley. An accused person has the
time?
Sorry, yes, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, please.
All right.
An accused person is entitled to the effective assistance of counsel at all critical stages of the prosecution. And under the United States Supreme Court's decisions in Missouri v. Frye and Lafler v. Cooper, this includes plea bargaining. Here, in connection with a formal plea offer from the state, defense counsel failed to correctly advise Mr. Mobley that he faced consecutive sentences on serious violent offenses if he was convicted at trial. In reliance on counsel's erroneous advice, Mr. Mobley refused the plea and went to trial. Under Lafler v. Cooper, he's entitled to remand to have the plea reoffered. The legal rule established in those cases requires a defendant alleging ineffective assistance in plea bargaining to show a formal offer from the state, deficient performance by counsel, and a reasonable probability that the plea would have been accepted by the trial court. In other words, that the defendant would have accepted the plea instead of going to trial, and that the plea offer would have been presented to the court and not withdrawn by the prosecution in light of intervening circumstances. And finally, that the conviction or sentence, or both, would have been less severe than was in fact imposed under the J&S entered by the court. Now, a reasonable probability certainly is not proof by preponderance of an evidence.
Don't
simply
we need a record?
A reasonable probability. And, Your Honor, this court has that record. This court has certainly a record of a formal plea offer. I don't think that there's any legitimate dispute that this offer, which was conveyed by the state to the defense in writing, set forth the applicable ranges, set forth what the state was prepared to recommend, what the state was prepared to dismiss, and what the state anticipated Mr. Mobley would face if convicted at trial, was a formal plea offer. And, you know, we look to, for example, if Mr. Mobley had accepted the plea offer and the state had unreasonably retracted it without contacting the victims, Mr. Mobley would certainly have been entitled to specific performance of that plea. We have a plea offer. Now, the state, I don't think, has disputed and can't really dispute that Mr. Mahoney's advice, his performance in this case, was deficient. He conceded on the record, I did not tell my client. I relied on this representation that the maximum, or as the memorandum submitted by the state, in fact, represented, the total time Mr. Mobley faced, if convicted at trial, was 378 months.
Is there a declaration from Mr. Mobley as to what it is that Phil Mahoney told him about the plea offer, and what evidence is there that it wouldn't have made a difference anyway he would have gone to trial?
There is no declaration, Your Honor. There is an offer of proof from Mr. Mahoney that Mr. Mobley relied on his advice, and there is the statement by Mr. Mahoney in court himself as an officer of the court stating, I did not tell my client about this. I didn't research it. Whether that was ineffective assistance, I can't say, but I didn't realize that this was an issue until after the fact.
You made a finding that the attorney-client privilege had been waived at any point. Is that right?
That's correct. And, in fact, that's a critical consideration with regard to some of the state's arguments in response. Because the biggest argument made by the state is that the record is inadequate. But essentially, this is, if there is any error, and we submit that the error is, you know, that the record is certainly adequate for the court to reach this claim, it was the record that was presented in Lafler, and I would refer the court, in Lafler, the court cited to the Court of Appeals decision, and all there was in the Court of Appeals, all there was in the district court in the habeas proceeding in Lafler was a statement by the defendant, I would have taken this plea, and the court found that this established a reasonable probability.
It came from the defendant's mouth, though. In other words,
yes.
It wasn't just the attorney saying, I'm making an offer of proof.
Yes, but certainly the court's entitled to rely on the attorney's offer of proof, since the attorney is an officer of the court. Now, the state also, and to the extent that the state has argued that the record is inadequate, this is an error that the state set up and invited. And I would refer the court to page 25 of the sentencing transcript on 427.12. Prosecutor says, it should be brought up on appeal as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. He's made his record now, and they can make the argument at that point. So I would submit that the state has now waived any argument that the record was inadequate. They have invited the error that they complained complain about. And furthermore, the trial court may well have relied on the state's representation he has made his record in justifying its decision to not inquire further. Now, we have separately assigned error to the court's failure to conduct an evidentiary hearing. I think the appropriate procedure probably would have been to appoint conflict counsel for Mr. Mobley to investigate further.
An evidentiary hearing wasn't necessary. So is that
That's correct. Well, to the extent, we don't believe that the state's arguments have any merit. We believe that the record is virtually identical to the record that was set up.
Well, how far does the court's obligation go? Your claim is that the court should have had an evidentiary hearing on this, but the dialogue in the trial court indicates that the issue wasn't properly noted, it wasn't previously raised, it hadn't been discussed, and there wasn't any briefing. So was the evidentiary hearing supposed to take place right then, or does the dilatory behavior of defense counsel require the court to grant a continuance of the proceedings in order to have this evidentiary hearing? What's the rule that you're asking us to enforce on trial judges?
We certainly don't punish the defendant when ineffective counsel has identified his own ineffectiveness in an ineffective way, sort of belatedly. I think Mr. Mahoney wasn't even aware of Lafler versus Cooper.
So
and
a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel is an exception to all procedural rules?
No, absolutely not, Your
Honor.
Only
some procedural rules.
The record is adequate, and the state said below that the record was adequate. We have ineffective counsel indicating, I did not give my client this advice. Now, for whatever reason, Judge Benton, it seems, was unaware of the case law, the cases that had been decided a month earlier, and the court, I think, for that reason, and the record makes this clear, inappropriately considered Mr. Mahoney's performance at trial essentially as a stopgap against the ineffective advice that came earlier, and so said, I'm not going to entertain an IAC claim. And so for that reason, I think the court, if I may speak a minute into my rebuttal, for that reason, the court did not essentially give any credence to the claim that ineffective assistance in plea bargaining of the type that was identified by Mr. Mahoney, I did not tell him about this direct consequence. In reliance on my advice, he elected to go to trial. The court plainly thought that was, not a justiciable claim, if you will, in light of his performance at trial. And I think the opinions in Frye and Lafler versus Cooper make it very clear that it was. I will reserve the remainder of my time for my rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Dennis McCurdy for the State of Washington, the respondent in this case. May it please the court. Under the facts that we have in this case, I would ask the court to deny the defense counsel's ineffective assistance of counsel claim and not remand this case back for the defendant to possibly enter a plea to contingent offer. I think it's important to note a couple things. First of all, what do you have to look at under the Supreme Court's case law? Under this particular case, wouldn't you have to, at a minimum, be able to look at what the defendant knew at the time of the entry of the plea, the possibility of the plea, so that he could compare the offer to what his sentence exposure was? It's not just what Mr. Mahoney might have said later on, because I think one of the things this court can ask and answer very simply is, what do we not know? We do not know exactly what Mr. Mahoney told the defendant. We do not know if he misadvised him or not, did not advise him at all. His statement is very unclear. It appears that he says, I should have researched that. Originally, defense counsel says, well, gosh, he misadvised him based on the state's memorandum. When I pointed out the state's memorandum was not incorrect, then they changed their position and said, well, maybe he didn't advise him at all. But we also don't know what Jesse DeBow told the defendant, who was on this case as defense counsel for approximately 6 months, either as standby counsel or direct counsel. We also don't know what the prosecutor may have told the defendant when the defendant was pro se, because they would have had conversations as well. And finally, what we don't know is we can't say not only what people told him, but what did the defendant actually know? And that's critical. We have no idea on the record that we have before the
Can't
court.
Can't we assume the defendant's testimony is going to be, I didn't know that was the offer I had?
Well, the offer was accurate. So the question...
Well, the offer didn't have the consecutive sentence in it that went to the longer term. Didn't it stop at 338 or 78 instead of 440?
Right, but the offer had no... The charges he was being offered to plead to, none of those convictions would have been consecutive sentences. They weren't serious violent offenses. The only thing that was serious violent offenses that would have potentially been consecutive was the charges as if he were convicted of all the counts that were serious violent offenses. Those are the only ones that would have potentially been consecutive, and that was not part of the state's offer. The state's offer did not, there was nothing inaccurate about the state's offer. The state's offer said, laid out all his criminal history, said if you're convicted of, and in fact it doesn't even say if you're convicted of everything, it says, 7 of the 9 pending charges, if you're convicted. And then if you're convicted of any one of the rape in the first degree or, I think it's the commercial sexual abuse of a minor, this is what you'd be looking at. So there was nothing that was inaccurate about that. And I think that's why defense is now backtracking from the original statement that he was misadvised based on the state's offer.
I'm still not tracking the math.
Okay.
Which is why I was a history major. But the offer references high end of the range at 318 months plus 5 years, so another 60 months to get to 378 months. And it refers that as the total time. What happened such that the sentence was 444 months rather than 378 months?
That's not what the offer was. That's what it was talking about. I think what you're referring to is what he was looking at, facing. And what he said was the prosecutor listed all the charges he was currently charged with. What he went to trial with and what he was currently charged with, they were different.
So they added, your office, there were charges added?
There was another charge filed? I'm sorry, what's that?
It was another information filed?
Yes.
After this?
Yes. There was one charge added. It was an unlawful possession of a firearm, and then one of the charges was reduced from Rob 1 down to Rob 2. What
consecutive offenses?
I'm sorry.
Potentially non-consecutive offenses.
Correct. That's correct. What the prosecutor outlined, which you're referring to, is not if he were convicted of everything. What he simply listed, and he states that in the memo, he says, here are the charges you face. If your offender score was a 9, this is the standard range on each one of those offenses. That is absolutely accurate. He wasn't saying this is your total sentence if you're convicted of all, because what he says above that in the paragraph, if you're convicted of 7 of the 9 offenses you face, and I'm not sure if he's referring to the prior or other cases as well, and you are convicted of any one of the rape offenses or the other offense that could be potentially consecutive, this is what the state would be asking for. He didn't say if you were convicted of both rapes. So, there's nothing inaccurate about that. But that is what he was saying you were potentially facing, and if you were convicted of a certain number of those charges and specific charges, never says this is what happens if you're convicted of all of them. That's not in this memo, and that's not actually portrayed at all. So I think, does that answer your question?
I think I understand, okay. But I'm going to exercise further diligence
okay.
later.
And then the second part of the memo, then he outlines the charges that are being offered to plead to. And that gives, a range. You know, I had to do my own flow chart of all this as well. I know the low end, I don't remember the actual full range off the top of my head. The offer was to 210 to 280 months. That was with the charges that were offered. None of those charges would have been had the possibility of being consecutive outside an exceptional sentence, which could not have been asked for because, of course, it wasn't pled. So there was nothing inappropriate about that. Let's go back to a moment to the claim that, gosh, there is a sufficient record, even if there's not the states to blame for this. Well, first of all, I don't know of an invited heir to an ineffective assistance of counsel claim or a claim that there's an insufficient record. It's not the state's obligation to make a sufficient record. It's also not an issue that's been raised in briefing as well. But let's look at what the trial court did, because the trial court entered a court order, a written court order, that set a deadline for when briefing and arguments had to be provided to the court. And that was, I believe, the 24th, after the defense requested a continuance of sentencing. Defense counsel provided briefing and argument to the court on other issues. Then he shows up at sentencing and raises an issue. Reluctantly, he says, Mr. Moberly has mentioned to me in lesser detail in the past an issue which he seeks to raise at this time. No briefing, no argument in violation of the court order, and zero notice to the court and to the prosecutor. And defense counsel now, in their new assignment of error, says the court was obligated to order an evidentiary hearing based on what happened here. Well, that would at best be an abuse of discretion standard. So what this court would have to find that no reasonable judge would have denied the a request, although there was no request for an evidentiary hearing, but would have ordered an evidentiary hearing when the motion is brought in violation of a court order with no notice, no briefing, and no argument. That's a tough row to handle.
The evidentiary issue came up on appeal for the first time in the reply brief.
That's correct. They brought up a new assignment of error when I pointed out there's insufficient record to decide this case. The bottom line, I think what I would say is three words: personal restraint petition. That's what these cases are for. This stuff is outside the record. It's necessarily outside the record. We would have a full right as the state to go into Mr. DeBow's file, to go into Mr. Mahoney's file, probably in-camera review on both to see what's work product and what's not. We would have the right to interview them, probably even have a right to interview the defendant, because at this point it's kind of a civil situation. He would have to have some sort of statement. There is none. For example, timing. If defense counsel claims that he thought it was concurrent and then he found out it was consecutive, well, when did he know that? Because if he knew it before trial, then I would say the issue would even be waived. You can't sandbag the state and wait until after trial and say, gosh, I didn't know it at the time the offer was made, therefore I need to go back and enter into a plea. All of those things are facts that this court doesn't know that would be flushed out at the type of hearing that a PRP is made for. If there's no other questions, I'd ask the court to deny defense motion. Thank you.
Very quickly, regarding the supplemental assignment of error, we filed a motion for permission to file a supplemental assignment of error, expressed no objection to the state filing a response. A commissioner granted the motion. The state was afforded the opportunity to respond, and the state did not do so. With regard to what Mr. DeBow or what the state may have told my client, those questions are first irrelevant. Mr. Mahoney was counsel of record. He was counsel for purposes of the Sixth Amendment, and he was the lawyer who was advising him and representing him at the time that the state conveyed this written formal plea offer to my client. Now, the state makes these sort of broad claims about what it would be entitled to do if this were brought up in a PRP. I beg to differ, because Mr. Moberly has not waived attorney-client privilege with regard to Mr. DeBow. There's no indication that an IAC claim against Mr. Mahoney would compel such a waiver. So for the state to claim that it would be entitled to go and dig through Mr. DeBow's files is, I think, simply wrong. With regard to what Mr. Mahoney advised him, again, the record is very clear. At pages 24 to 25, Mr. Mahoney says, he was misled. I should have researched him. I should have advised him the consecutive service of sentences on various counts was a possibility, instead of relying on the memorandum. So whether or not Mr. McCurdy thinks that the prosecutor's memorandum was clear, Mr. Mahoney plainly did not. plainly relied on that memorandum and plainly used that essentially as his starting and ending point in advising Mr. Mobley regarding his exposure at trial. Now, essentially, the state's saying, even though there was a record, even though we have an admission of ineffective assistance, an admission of deficient performance, and I don't think Mr. McCurdy is contesting that, the state is essentially seeking to engage in this sort of Monday morning quarterbacking, which Justice Scalia, in his dissent, sort of lamented would be the consequence of these kinds of claims on appeal. And like it or not, Mr. McCurdy is stuck with the majority opinion in both Lafler versus Cooper and Frye.
Why don't we avoid that by simply saying you've got your PRP option, go hold your hearings, develop the testimony, rather than have counsel come and say, oops, I'm now facing convictions that were bigger than the offer.
Well,
I want the offer now.
This court, if I may answer the court's question, this court can certainly reach an IAC question on direct appeal where the record exists. It is our submission that the record is more than adequate, is equivalent to the records in Lafler versus Cooper and Frye, and to essentially relegate this to a circumstance where Mr. Mobley would not have the assistance of counsel and force him to get that information from prison is, I think, an unfair, unduly harsh, and unjust result given the record that currently exists.
Thank you.
Thank you.